with Gav Thompson.
Hello, you're listening to the Do Lectures podcast with me, Gav Thompson. Welcome back. This is season 4, Living Your Best Life. I once worked on a very famous ad campaign where the end line was, good things come to those who wait. Horses, surfers, and black Irish beer. Gosh, it feels like good things come to those who wait for anyone who has waited for season 4 of our podcast. Apologies, it's been a long time coming. Yes, things like work and life got in the way, but we're back, and I genuinely think living your best life is certainly for me the most interesting of the seasons we've had so far. It taps into what makes people happy, what makes people sad, advice for people that have lived a great life and a not so great life, and just some simple transferable wisdom on what it takes to live your best life. We've got some amazing guests lined up, and I'm really excited. I think it really fits and sits with the Do Lectures essence extremely well. So thank you for joining today. I hope you like this one. We're off with a cracker to start with. So yeah, this one has been a long time coming. This was recorded a while back with the amazing Sarah Cox, who is somebody that I have admired for a long time as living her best life. I think she does it in a very infectious way. She does it in a very authentic way. And I really liked our chat. I think it was, she gave a really honest, authentic interview for someone that spends her life talking for a living. It felt actually a real honour to be asking the questions for a change. So anyway, please sit back, put your feet up, grab a coffee, and listen to Sarah Cox, Living Your Best Life. So welcome to Living Your Best Life with the Do Lectures, Sarah Cox.
Hello. I just thought I'd pause dramatically there before saying hello.
Well, you're good at that, aren't you? First of all, I owe you an apology, and then I owe you a piece of gratitude. So my apology is, and this is for the benefit of the listeners as well, I've been chasing Sarah to do this podcast for a while, and I got a provisional yes, which was very good of her. And then, bizarrely, we bumped into each other at a festival back in the summer, a festival, and I thought that was a good time to try and close the deal of the podcast. She'd already said yes, it was penciled in, and I kept bumping into her and going, all right, Coxie, all right with the podcast. And I think every time I did that, I'd probably decrease the chances of this conversation ever happening. Is that fair?
Yeah, the podcast definitely got delayed by eight days with every approach that you made as you got drunk and drunker. And we should really point out as well that when you say we met at a festival and bestival, it was Camp Bestival, which is a family festival. You know, one of the headliners, Mr. Tumble, but still you saw fit to get absolutely actually, I can't lie, so were me and Ben by the end as well. When we used to take the kids, I used to have one small glass of red wine because we were just so worried about a three-year-old legging it. But now that the youngest is 11, we can get a little bit loose at Camp Bestival, and it's all the better for it.
Yeah, no, I had my daughter with me, but my wife very kindly took her home or took her back to the tent early. But yeah, I decided that every time I saw you, I was going to just try and get a little bit closer to closing the deal. Anyway,
also, it's a pleasure to be here. The Coxie thing is interesting because I'm trying to shake it off a little bit like Katie Price, perhaps a bad example, but the way Katie Price has tried to, you know, offload Jordan. I mean, remember Jordan, we don't refer to as Jordan anymore. And so I'm trying to, you know, Coxie very much 90s, very much a marble light in one hand, a bit of body in the other, stumbling out of somewhere.
Stumbling out of the
possibly
Met Bar.
Wearing a parka over a tight dress. And now, obviously, luckily, I'm now Radio 2-ified, which means I'm sat here with a retriever on my lap.
And talking to me about living your best life.
Having a cup of tea.
Well, actually, so that's the second bit, which is, and again, sorry about the coxy thing, but I grew up with you on the Girly Show in the 90s.
You grew up with me. How old are you? You must be, are you the same age, a bit older?
I'm 50. Younger? 50.
There we go. Okay, good.
Yeah. So you're always been coxy to me.
You can't say you grew up with me. I mean, I wasn't on telly as like a 12-year-old. I was like 21. So
yeah, okay. In my mind, you were there.
It would take most of my 20s to grow up, to be fair.
And then the other slightly strange thing is that I definitely wanted you to talk to you because I think the story you're about to talk about is inspirational in any sense. But in the series when I was trying to kind of get you over the summer was Being Amazing Despite. And actually, I couldn't think of what the despite was with you. And actually, at that festival, and maybe these were lying, maybe they weren't, I was lying on one of those big orange inflatable sofas. You know the ones that like Mick Jagger's lips? You know those big
things? Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I was lying on that. Watching, I'd love to say I was watching you, but I wasn't. But watching someone that come after you, Groove Armada maybe, and this guy just came up to me, looked down at me, gave me the double thumbs up, went, "You're living your best life, mate." And there was maybe some association between living your best life, that festival, you, and I thought that whole notion of how do you live your best life is an interesting one to tap into. Hence why we're here, hence why you're my first guest, and hence why I want to talk to you about living your best life.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Gav. I'm glad we got round to it.
Thanks. I'm glad you didn't bin me after my ridiculous Mr. Ben behaviour at the festival. Ooh, Coxy! Anyway, look, read your book. Love your book, Till the Cows Come Home. Little plug there. I guess, look, we could try and summarise the book quickly. I guess the interesting thing about reading it is just quite how sort of normal your life was, which maybe is the basis for what we're about to talk about. But for those guests that haven't read your book or have been living in a cave, and we have lots of listeners in the US, can you give me the short version of your life up until the point you were dancing around on my TV screen?
Definitely. Okay. So born 1974, the youngest of five, to a man called Len, who's a farmer. Cattle farmer, pedigree polled Herefords for fans of cows, brown and white ones for non-cow fans, and the beautiful yet diminutive Jackie. And grew up quite happy at Bolton. Parents split up when I was 6 or 7, but I was up at my dad's a lot riding ponies. He tried to stop me liking boys, kept trying to point me towards ponies. Eventually, I stopped riding ponies. Gone back to it now, though, funnily enough. And school, all that good. Didn't really want to go to uni because my sister was there and she kept complaining that her and her five housemates could only afford one potato each for tea and they all shared shoes and it was terrible, poverty-stricken student life. And I thought, I don't fancy that much. Funnily enough, visiting that very same sister in Paris as part of her degree, because she was doing French, obviously, I got scouted for modelling and I was a below average model for a couple of years, combined it with working behind the bar of the pub where my mum and stepdad lived by that point. And anyway, the one day after a couple of years of that, travelling South Korea, Milan, New York, I eventually got to a casting for something called The Girly Show, which I nearly didn't go to the casting. I was skint. My mum lent me a couple of quid, to which I pay her back handsomely now each week for that. And she, without her, I wouldn't be sat here now with my lovely dogs in my lovely house because it was for The Girly Show, which led to the rest of my career. The Girly Show, don't Google it. It was a late night political discussion show. Very highbrow.
Yeah, it was really highbrow. It was really boring. You got Michael Portillo talking about economic financial principles. I wouldn't.
Exactly.
There's nothing to see there.
Definitely not three gobby young women with a bit too much cleavage on show calling people wankers. Definitely
wankers of the
not
week.
That.
I remember, what's his name? Peter Andre got a particularly brutal.
Yeah, it was horrible.
Have you ever made. It's horrible. Yeah, it's quite brutal. Have you ever made amends with him, or is that you done now with him?
You know what? I was very proud of my wankers. I wrote them myself, and funnily enough, I think that's what started off my love for writing, was crafting a wanker every week. It was really satisfying, you know, I love language and love writing. So that was the first experience of doing that, you know, beyond, you know, my A level English lit or whatever. And perhaps you'd not seen it. Patsy Kensett, I did as Wanker of the Week. I think her crime just happened to be that she was getting a lot of stick in the press for always going out with rock stars. So I hopped on that old bandwagon. So we had to find a wanker every week. So we plumped for her and I did it. It was all like, you're supposed to look on the dating pages. See, this was before internet dating was a thing. This is how long ago it was. You're supposed to check out the dating pages, not the top 10 charts, to find a man. It was something like that. I thought it was ever so witty. And then I saw a classic 90s story in Nobu, and she was the loveliest, the warmest, the nicest woman. And since then, she's got such grace and class. And since then, I've been like a really big fan of hers, because I was like, oh, I'm an idiot. And then I was backstage at Top of the Pops a couple of weeks after that went out on the telly. And Liam Gallagher like called me a horrible swear word backstage, and I couldn't listen to Oasis for about 2.5 weeks.
So is anyone still carrying a grudge? Peter Andre will no, park
I
here.
Don't think so.
That was quite, it was quite brutal, actually.
You know what? I think I've seen Peter. It was kind of like, let me try and do a bit of a spin on this. It was very much of its time, and in a way it was an accolade. Everybody wanted to be that particular wanker that week.
It was a privilege.
It's horrible. I mean, I wouldn't do it now. I mean, my poor dad, I went for modelling, which was just nice, you know, nice pictures of me pounced by a canal or whatever. And to suddenly just being on the telly calling people wankers. And my poor
dad.
There's
one of them, there's one of them where your mum's in the audience. It's Robbie Williams, I think. And you're really going hard on him. And they cut to your mum, and I'm not sure she's quite sure how to react. Like, obviously, her daughter's done looking great on the telly, but she's really going in on Robbie Williams.
It's great, my mum. She's been there throughout it all, and she's come down for some pretty wild nights in the Met Bar. Like, I could just throw her into any social situation. All 4'11" of her will completely handle anything. But I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it now. It just kind of, you know, it just was quite that sort of post-pub TV.
Different times, Sarah. So one of the, so this kind of tiny bit leads me on to the thing, really, which is, I've been obviously doing my research with you, trying to work out why you have, or how you've become so, amazing, right? I don't think there's that many other of your peer group from the Girly Show who are now national treasures. I'm going to put that out there. You're a national treasure. And have managed to sort of segue from quite edgy, quite sort of edgy, highbrow political debate into, you know, frankly being a nation's sweetheart and, you know, a bastion of light entertainment. And I was trying to work out why you've managed to do it. I think I've got a couple of reasons or suggestions, but why don't you go first? How come you've managed to sort of segue from being a farmer's daughter to a model to a late night TV presenter to something that's bigger, broader, with mass appeal?
Well, firstly, thanks for all those lovely adjectives you used about me there, Gav. One day I hope to achieve true treasuredom. The simple answer is that the second decade of my career, I've spent making up for the first decade and trying to not reinvent myself, because I've always kind of just stayed myself, but trying to reinvent myself in the minds of TV execs and commissioners so that they realise that actually I've changed and I've grown up and I'm not the woman, the young woman who I was when I was, you know, basically a gob on a stick, perhaps a little bit saucy, a bit of innuendo, you know, that I'd grown out of that. But it did take, you know, I've been 25 years men and boy in the biz, and it's you know, the past 10 years, touch wood, things have been going great, especially the last sort of 6 or 7 maybe have been fantastic. Touch wood, long may it continue. But before that, there was definitely a period for a few years where I was, you know, definitely in a bit of a low point career-wise. It did coincide with me having 3 young children.
Yeah.
So I could, which I've jokingly done in interviews only as a joke, you know, I could say, hey, I just stepped back because I really wanted to look after my kids, yeah. But the truth is, you know, I did go back to work when they were sort of 5 months old because I had to, because there was work on offer at Radio 1. So it was a career break-ish. I was on the radio once or twice a week, just at the weekends at Radio 1, but it wasn't really through choice. It was through, I just wasn't really getting any of the other work. So it's taken a while to switch people around. I'm really grateful to Radio 1 because they stuck with me. They could have binned me off and they stuck with me. And I'm really pleased they did, because that then led to Radio 2. But also the Great Pottery Throwdown, made by Love Productions, who do Bake Off. They gave me a chance to present that after I'd done like a Children in Need version of The Sewing Bee, which they also make. And that really made a difference, because suddenly Sarah Cox wasn't sort of, you know, shouty, or, you know, I was suddenly there next to a potter's wheel, being charming, being trying to be funny, trying to get a laugh. That's just in my bones, because I'm the youngest of 5. You know, the fruit's not fallen far from the tree with my mum. She likes to make people laugh. Her dad wanted to be a stand-up. He went to comedy school, like clown school or something in the 60s or 70s. So I still wanted to make people laugh, but commissioners realised that actually I could do it in a warm way and I could draw people out of themselves, which I think I'm all right at. And so, yeah, that's quite a long answer, actually, wasn't it?
But that's it's a good answer, and it's a better answer than I've got, because I've got a kind of annoying kind of commissions answer, because as you know, I spent many years in advertising and I spent my life researching potential, you know, spokespeople, brand ambassadors, celebrities. You remind me of George Clooney, actually.
A lot of people say that. Is it the eyes?
It's just the general
demeanor.
Is it
the whiff of coffee?
It's the appeal. So yeah, I remember doing some research on, I think the brief was find the most relatable person in the UK. And we kept, for this audience, our audience, whatever we call ourselves, and George Clooney came back as the sort of, he's the guy that most women would like to go to bed with and most men would like to be mates with. Now,
yeah,
there's not a direct link between you and him, but my view of you in relatability is that, you know, since you've said yes to this months ago and I've been chasing you around festivals, all my female friends gone, oh my God, I love Coxie. I just want to go for a drink with her. She's amazing. And actually, the boys will say the same. They're kind of like, she wanted to be my mate. She's funny. She's a laugh. She takes a piss. And that's that kind of universal relatability linked with my other amazing genius insight, which is that you are a bit different. You march to a different beat. You're not polished RP. You know, we know there's lots of people out there who have conformed when their agent's gone, oh, don't do this or do that, or the commissioner said, it seems like you've not done that. You've just been Sarah, yes, with your ups and downs, and I'll come to that in a minute, but you've got this amazing duality with men and women and kids and grandparents, but and also you're just authentic, and it's sort of, I'm sort of blowing smoke at your ass a tiny bit, and I apologise, but it's
yeah,
it's
no,
kind
I'm
of,
thoroughly it, into it.
It's just... It's special.
You can tell. You can actually, from the text that I get to the Tea Time show on Radio 2, it is. There's lots of women, but there's also lots of men. There's lots of wagon drivers and lots of lovely blokes as well. We get a lot of blokes on our 5:40 feature, and kids, and you know, it's. But like you say, yeah, I'm not. I can't really shape myself to be a certain way, but I've perhaps grown into, you know, my headphones at Radio 2, and I've naturally become, you know, a Radio 2 broadcaster, which is what I always wanted to be. It was always a dream to get a daily show on radio too. So I've reached, you know, the pinnacle. So the pinnacle so far. So I'm very lucky. I mean, I'm obsessed with the show, Gab. Like, I will wake up.
It's amazing.
I want to improve it. I don't want to tread water. It's my obsession. I absolutely love my show. You know, I never call it in. I'm just like, and if I'm in a bad mood, if I've not done in my eyes a great show, forgetting that people are busy, they might just tune in for 20 minutes as they pop into Tesco or whatever. You know, people aren't studying it, but I'm my own worst critic, and I do absolutely, you know, love it.
Can I ask you tiny bit of an annoying question? Which is, it's a two-part, it's not really a two-part, it's kind of like, how do you do it? The answer is not, I've got loads of research and I spend hours on it every day. I think there's a theory that we all know about, but in life you're either a radiator or a drain. And some people are radiators, you clearly are. But when I was thinking about you, certainly during lockdown, you've got, you know, I don't know the numbers, but it's many millions of people who, for 2 hours a day in the afternoon, you are their radiator. You are their, particularly in lockdown, people having a crappy life, particularly maybe people who couldn't get out and about, and you're all there doing what you do, giving people some fun, some upbeat, in frankly pretty tough times, right? So you're kind of swimming uphill, and you did it because I was listening. I was there. Was there ever a point where you kind of just turn off the mic at 7 o'clock and go, bloody hell, that's hard work, but you're radiating all this energy and positivity and love and support and humour, frankly. It's quite hard work, isn't it?
Actually, I've got to be honest, it's not hard work at all. I tell you what, which sounds really cheesy, is if I am feeling a bit like that, whatever mood I'm in when I get to Radio 2, and it's normally, to be fair, I've really battled for this job. So when often I've said that,
in,
you know,
you're
my
literally
career,
babbling straight into the studio.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a while where with my career, I was like that squirrel at the start of the Ice Age film, just clinging onto that nut, whatever happened, just trying to hold on to that nut. And I was like that with my career. So I'm very, you know, I'm so happy to be there. But whatever mood I am when I turn up, it's normally pretty good. I'm in an even better one by the time I've finished. I enjoy the show every day. What was different during lockdown was that we felt, it felt very nice to have been of use, to have helped people, because normally, you know, we try and crack jokes, try and make people laugh, we jolly them along, and actually to feel like we really did help people, which is a lot of the feedback that we've had. A lot of listeners tell me off air, you know, when we've done the quiz or whatever, and then I say bye to them and stuff, and a lot of them will tell me that it was nice to hear a familiar voice. And I was the same, you know, with listening to Lisa on a Saturday, you know, early evening, listening to Lisa Tarbuck. It was nice just to have that familiar voice. It wasn't a struggle. The hardest bit was the news, which I fade down in the studio and just watch the clock because I thought the top story won't be longer. The news is 5 minutes and I had to skip the first 3 minutes and then keep checking because obviously I don't want it to end and me not to be ready to go. Because, you know, once... You know, there was just one day where a nurse had died. I think she was in her mid-30s and she had 3 children. And I was just like, I just can't listen to this. And then open my mic and off we go. I had to kind of suspend reality for 2 hours a little bit and be the escape for people. And actually, it was an escape for me, you know, because I suspended reality for me as well, for my mental health as well. It was really helpful, I think.
I mean, the thing about your show, which again I think is one of its, you know, amazing things, is you know the audience are very much part of it. The listeners are part of the show. It's a kind of, it's a bit of co-creation, as we'd say in the ad industry. It just, there must be some days, so not as serious as the ones we just mentioned. Sometimes we go, oh God, I haven't had any sleep. The puppy's been up all night. Kids been up all night. I've got a hangover. Someone's just dinged my car. Because what we're in the business of here, I'm trying to help people learn from one of the maestros, yourself, and how you can snap out of crappiness into your A game.
I'm probably like the worst person to ask. I should have
to open this season. I wish
because
I had chased you around all those
Jack, like,
festivals.
I've got my dream job. Sorry, so I'm like in a really bad position to sort of, you know, advise and how to pick yourself up. But tell you what, I did grow up with my mum when we had the pub. That no matter what was going on in her life and stress with family and stress with just, you know, juggling, you know, running a pub and running teenagers, was that she very much had, well, she used to say, once my lippy goes on and I get behind that bar, then, you know, she's on show, she's there and everything, you know, she's got to suppress anything stressful going on. And so, you know, I guess I've got a bit of that sort of grit where it's like, once you're on air, you're just on air and you just got to push through. And I guess in other work that I've done, look, it helps to remind you, it helps sometimes to have a bit of a dip in your career because it gives you much more humility when you get back. You're much more grateful. Don't take anything for granted. And I think it's actually quite healthy to have a bit of a dip sometimes because, you know, when you do then get like, you know, a bit of a bad day, you can kind of remind yourself that you've been in a much worse situation.
Again, the dip is my next question. Okay, last, just look, you work in an industry which you know way better than I, because I don't work in it, but I work in advertising, which has similar traits. But both the kind of the job you do and the lifestyle you lead is kind of designed to sort of thin your skin, right? You know, both in the job you do, you know, you get rejection all the time, you're not tall enough, you're not short enough, you're not pretty enough, you're not funny enough. You know, there's just, it's not a job for thin-skinned people. And then when you add to that, which is a bit of what I learned in advertising, the lifestyle of, okay, you're gonna, here's loads of alcohol and here's loads of fine around the world, telling you're amazing, here's loads of drugs, here loads of hangers-on. You've got these kind of dual things of the sort of physicality and the lifestyle, which for a lot of people, as we all know, grind them down. And frankly, they don't live the best life, they live the worst life, and they have often quite public, you know, displays of that. And again, is it that you just were, you know, farmer's daughter, mum works in a pub, youngest of five, you look like a scallion, as you said. I don't know why that helps. But, you know, you had thick skin and you were resilient, or have you learnt it along the way? What's, again, trying to help our listeners who want to be aspiring, you know, TV stars, how do you, any tips?
Well, I think I got given a good grounding by the way I was raised with my mum. I think helps a lot in that, you know, no, it's really hard one to answer, to be honest. I guess it changes as you go through your career, doesn't it? So you do care less about what people think of you as you get older, and you do know your own worth a bit more, and you do know when you're good at your job. So as you progress through your career, it's more about listening to your internal voice rather than listening to anybody else. To get to that position, you have to get quite successful first, I feel, you know, because then you start thinking, oh yeah, I was right. I'm right to believe in myself. So if that ever wobbles, you know, I just come straight back down to having a really good group of friends. And I've got to say, a very supportive husband who is a partner in everything. So we're a good team. And I think if you've got that, just to take it, you know, when things are getting tough, if you've got, you know, a stable family life, which, you know, I've had times where I've not with my first marriage. If you've got a stable family life, that makes a hell of a difference to you, because that's not one of your worries. That's one of the columns holding you up alongside, you know, my upbringing as well, and being told that I could do stuff and being reassured and supported and loved. You know, I think in 20s, advertising, not that different from a lot of, you know, creative industries where there's a lot of money floating around. There are a lot of temptations, and it's the same with TV work. But you know, I think if, as long as you just keep your eye on the ball as much as you can and, you know, not always be the last to leave the party, then you can just push through that. I mean, it's kind of what your 20s are for, really. So it just, you know, if you can push through that and then essentially just grow out of it, innit? Just get too tired to go out.
Just try and get to act three, right? I mean, act two is always tricky because a lot of people blitz out in act two and you know, I guess Davina McCall, Richard Madey, Jonathan Ross, the three of them have something to play in your life, which I know about because I've done my research. Can you share with our listeners how they helped you?
Yeah, so Davina's incredible. She's kind of like a fairy godmother, but with incredible abs. And there's been a couple of times where she's just like appeared in my life and helped me out. She's a pal, but not pals like we're having sleepovers. She's, you know, I did have her number. She's so successful and I was having a real dip in my career. And I texted her something like, oh, just really struggling, like I'm not getting the work I like. And at the time, my agent was taking me around like a maid and aunt trying to marry me off, but was taking me around to commissioners like, remember her, but Sarah, is it coming back to you now? She's funny, she's warm, she's nice, you know, hoping that, you know, it's like, throw me a freaking bone here, like hoping I'd get some little job. And anyway, I texted Davina and Davina never texts back. She rings immediately, which is kind of annoying because you're like, oh, I just wanted to send a bit of a whingy text and she'd send me a little platitude back and then I'd go and have a sandwich. But instead she rings and she tackles it and you're like, oh. So she was like, you need to get sorted. You're brilliant, but you need to get sorted out. Speak to this man. And it was Michael Heppel. And he's written lots of books and I really recommend his books. He works with sort of top athletes and people in industry, successful people, politicians, and business people, all about confidence and self-belief and being proactive. And he's brilliant. Him and his wife, Christine, they're just a fantastic couple of people. It also helps that they've got the most beautiful Durham burr to their accent, so a northeast gorgeous accent. Anyway, he came round and was, he had me, I was in tears because like, I just felt so low and he was so brilliant. And this takes me back to what I was saying about having, you know, a good home life, because he made me draw, and it's very good to do. I would recommend you do it. And if anything, it could just make you feel quite good and you know what to work on. So you draw a sort of beach ball and you cut it into segments, maybe like six on each side. So you've got a sort of 12 piece pie. And on one side is sort of your home life. So, you know, your relationship, all the different bits there, you know, kids, all this. And you sort of like, you draw in, like if it's full, then obviously it'd look like a full sort of circle, like a full ball. If like my career and everything was fine, it'd all be full and round and bouncy. And as it was like my fully inflated half was my home life and the career side for like, you know, how satisfied do you feel? How confident do you feel, you know, how successful do you feel, you know, it was all dented in like the where I'd put the markers closer to the center. So that side was all sort of, you know, deflated and crumpled in. And that was the side that needed boosting up with my career side. But, you know, I'd rather it that way around, to be honest. I mean, I'd rather have a full ball, but I'd rather it be the home life is sorted.
We all love a full ball, don't we?
So basically, I'd rather have like, I'd rather have the, you know, it's good to have your own life sorted and then try and work on your career, and it helps to have that support. So Michael said to me, you have got to, it's a little bit sort of feel the fear-ish. He went, choose some people who you're going to ring up and you're going to get advice from them. So I was like, okay. And I chose Richard Madeley, which was a bit cheaty because I kind of knew him a bit just from going on This Morning a lot, and I always really liked him and Judy. So Richard Madeley and Jonathan Ross, who I sort of knew to be like, say hi to and stuff. And I sort of went for coffees with them separately. I just reached out and said, I'd love some advice. And I just went for coffees and just to get advice on how to make my career better. Which is so
funny. It's a funny thing to say now, yeah.
But I think it did kind of help, because doing something so ridiculous, yeah. But, you know, the thinking is, the worst that can happen is if say no. So I would recommend people do it, because it's kind of a buzz. And actually, people like to be asked advice. They like to feel like they can help, because, you know, it gives them a little bit of a boost. So if there's, you know, if your listeners, you know, if you're at work and there's some things that you're struggling with things, just be proactive, offer to meet someone up, lure them there with promises of frothy coffee or hard booze or dancing boys, whatever it is. And then just, you know, just say, I'd love your advice. I'm having a bit of a struggle work-wise. And I think you're ace. Come and tell me how to do it, to book my ideas up. And that's kind of what I did. And for meeting Michael, there was definitely an upward trajectory, and I don't know why. Witchcraft, I imagine. That's what they do up in Durham. No, not really. So I imagine I just got a bit more confident and just a bit more kind of like go-gettery.
I think there's...
You know what I will say? The only bit of career advice I've got that is any use is to be the squeaky wheel, if you can. To be, if there's, you know, if you want to move forward in your career, if you want something at work, is to just ask and just to say, rather than saying, can we meet up at some point? I mean, I was in a good position. I was at Radio 1, but I was coming to the end of my time there. I mean, Fern Cotton couldn't keep having babies, you know, forever. And I was doing a lot of her maternity leave. I was like, yes, good.
A lot of those pins in condoms.
Keep impregnating, yeah. You keep cracking on with the beautiful Fern, because I need that work and to do the maternity cover. So I was in a good position, but it was never like, you know, getting my agent to ring, you know, the head of Radio 2. I was emailing him near enough on a weekly basis going, do you want to meet 4 o'clock for a coffee at such a place at, you know, on Great Portland Street? Let's meet for a coffee. I've just got a few ideas, you know, and I mithered him. I basically mithered him into giving me a job. And
like
actually,
me,
he really liked
festival.
That because, yeah, exactly. I was like, oi, oi, absolutely smashed. No, I didn't do that. But yeah, so I bothered them into giving me a job. It's like, shut up, come and do like it middle of the night. You know?
I do think I think the squeakiest wheel makes the most noise is a lovely little thing soundbite to take out of this conversation, because it's when you're in the when you're feeling crap about your life, you lose your confidence. You just think you've lost your voice, and you're sitting there often in your head, sometimes with your partner, your family, going, I can do this. I can do this. I'll be good at this. But you haven't got the confidence to say that. And it's really important message, I think, to just go, just put it out there. What's the worst that's going to happen? And actually, in your case, in all of our cases, do you know what? It's good advice. Just get out there. And if you've got the backing of someone who's supportive and knows what I'm talking about, in the case of Richard Bailey or Jonathan Ross, can't say everyone's going to have that behind them. But just give it a go, yeah?
Yeah, because people do like to help, and it is that, it's exactly that, Gav. It is exactly what's the worst that can happen, you know. I mean, they're not going to headbutt you. Then you're not going to get in trouble for asking. The worst that can happen is they'll be a bit awkward and might not be up for it. But you know what? I think people,
they want to help. Flattered. They do. Everyone wants to help. They want to feel
good. They
want
to help
about,
because it's kind of a compliment.
We're all good people.
You know, you're saying. Especially if you tag on a little, look, your career is just really great and inspiring, and I would love 20 minutes of your time. Dancing boys on me. Yeah, give me a bit of advice.
So one of the things that unites a lot of people that come to the Do Lectures in person is, you know, when you talk to them afterwards, they go, they were at a crossroads in their life. There was some big juncture, some big decision. They weren't sure how to make that decision. I mean, your career path from farmer's daughter to pub landlord's sort of, you know, action woman to supermodel in Korea to... it's your words, not mine, actually. It's in your book. To TV, to radio, back to TV, to back being this kind of light entertainment juggernaut. You must have hit some crossroads. And I guess the it's a two-parter to my listeners. You know, how do you know you're at a big crossroads, and how? What's any tips for making the right decision? Because sometimes you only realise later on that those decisions are going to be life-changing.
I'm a huge believer in following your instinct. I think sometimes in the career, it's what you say no to rather than what you say yes to, which makes all the difference. And, you know, there's been sometimes where I've been, you know, where work's been a bit slow. But, you know, some talking head show, some rubbishy shows come up and I've just said no, because it's just like, I don't think it's right for me. So I guess if you're in a job that you love and that you're good at, to just keep believing in yourself. And if there are, you know, other offers of other stuff, even it might be quite nice to have a change. You know, you've got to follow your instincts and think, you know, is it, if it's really for you. Crossroads wise, I mean, there's been moments where, you know, it's hard to relate it to different work though. I don't know how it'd quite work. You know, there's been moments where like work has been so quiet and you start to look and try and blame other elements, because you think, God, I'm, you know, just doing my best here to keep my career going. And, you know, there were moments a few years ago now where I was thinking, even though I've been really good friends with my agent and I've been with her for years, I was thinking maybe it's that, you know, you just start casting around a bit in desperation, like what is the missing piece here? And actually I stuck with her. And that was probably one of the best decisions I ever made. The first best decision I made was getting on her books in the first place and bumping into her after a girly show recording when I was 21, on the escalators at the now defunct BBC at White City there. And then the next best one was sticking with her. So I guess in a way it's like, you know, it's about loyalty really, and about keeping, you know, keep believing in yourself and the people around you.
So you might have just answered.
I'm a bit. Go on.
Well, you might have answered my last question.
I'm quite a believer in work karma. Very big on treating people well, especially
on the way up. I mean, you'll get really, it on the way down, yeah.
Yes. So you really do learn that when you have a couple of blips in your career.
Of course.
You don't want to be a pain in the ass, because, you know, it will come and bite you on your own ass at some point. But again, I think that comes with maturity. You know, I used to float around at 21 thinking, this is it now, I've got a career. Great. And then I didn't. I just had, you know, a little weekend show. So, yeah, I'm a big believer in, I don't do it just so in case I meet them again in the future and they're my boss. But I mean, especially somewhere like the BBC, you know, the woman now, there's a woman at Radio 2 called Philippa, who I always got on with really well. She used to like make my tea. She was an assistant producer, and she's like quite a high up exec now at Radio 2, and has done brilliantly. And you get quite a bit of that, you know, people at the BBC they'll just work their way up. And I guess it's like that in a lot of industries where, you know, and also you just don't want to be, I hate the thought of anyone just going home going, God, she's a right pain in the arse, that Sarah, you know. And so I try my best, you know, to be good to people and to make an effort and to be professional.
You may have just answered the question, but I'm going to just push you. Top three tips to our listeners in how to live your best life.
Work-wise?
Just generally. You know, just generally. I mean, but I'm going to come full circle. I've seen you at a festival with your beautiful kids, your beautiful husband, on stage, doing your DJing thing in front of 20,000 people, wearing your sparkly dress and your cowboy boots / welly boots, playing 80s music. And there was a moment where I could have taken a photo of that and your kids were off stage or whatever, on stage. They were on stage, weren't they, at one point? She is living her best life, right? With all that in mind, Sarah, what are your top three tips for living your best life?
I think definitely always follow your instinct. Listen to that tiny little voice inside. Whether, you know, it comes to what start are you going to order in a restaurant or what job are you going to take? or what you're going to do next, you know, in your career. So my three tips will be always follow your instinct, follow your inner voice, and trust it. Trust yourself, trust your judgment, I guess. Another one would be keep your good crew of very best friends close, because they're worth their weight in gold. When, you know, through good times and bad and all that, without getting too Hallmark cards, you know, you just, there's been occasions where I would have been lost without my very best friends. So definitely keep your, you know, your old mates, your proper mates gathered around you. Hold them close to your bosom. And always have, you know, a nice bottle of Merlot in the house would be my three. That's as far, yeah, as deep
as that's good. My one is marry your best friend, or make sure your husband and wife is your best friend. That's a pretty solid tip, right?
Yeah, that definitely helps. Absolutely.
Can I just try something at you? I was once told, if you're ever going to make a really big decision in your life, make sure that at least somebody whose opinion you value disagrees with what you're about to do, because that means you're taking the path less travelled. You've listened to your friends. You know, you're not doing it unconsciously. You're going, I want to do this. You've listened to the feedback, and then you go and do it. Given your career path is not linear, right? It's amazing, but it's quite kind of zigzaggy. Has there ever been a moment where people have gone, say, I'm not sure you should be doing that, but you've done it anyway?
No, not really. I don't think so. I don't really ask friends for advice. I don't ask friends for career advice, because when I will sometimes talk about work with friends, but what I want to talk, what I just want to just really, I mean, I do, it'll eventually we'll start talking about work, and some of my friends I know through work. So, you know, it's good. I'll use them as a sounding board, you know, occasionally, but, as for like,
it's not all work, though, is it?
No, there's been a couple of gigs and stuff where I've been like not sure, and I've rang. But it's a bit different because she's sort of in the industry. She's like a publicist, and is my publicist as well, who happens to be my best mate before she became a publicist. So one of my best mates. So, you know, it's a bit different because she's really qualified to answer.
Okay, it's not all about work, but anyway, we're part of that. Final question. Is there anyone you've met on your travels that you think is living their best life, that, you know, is a good poster child for the LYBL crappy acronym ad man?
It's a lot of the time. I mean, I kind of... sometimes I feel quite envious of listeners that we get on. We had somebody come on last night on the 540 feature, and she spent 20 years in forensics in the police force, right, and is now a dog groomer in her shed in her back garden, and she's got 8 dogs. And I just thought, God, that's...
She's living her best life, right?
That's awesome, yeah. She paddle boards with one of them, a one-eyed spaniel. Another one, its back legs are out, so she's got like a little wheel, you know, it's got wheels attached to it. And I just thought, God, that's a person who thought, I've done forensics for 20 years. I mean, imagine the sights she's seen for her career.
Gosh.
And then she's knocking it on the head and following, you know, a dream of being a dog groomer and having tons of dogs. So I think I meet people a lot in this job where I just think, wow, they're really, you know, they're really following their dreams and living their best life.
So you have been an amazing guest. I know you don't realise this right now, but you have been.
And you have been my poster child
of someone that's living their best life. And I'm really grateful that you've come eventually, and I've tracked you down, and you've done it. And I really appreciate it. And I'm sure our listeners do. And you definitely are. You're living your best life, and keep it up, whatever you're doing.
It was a pleasure, Gav, and good luck. Good luck with all of this.
Thank you, Sarah.
With your podcasting empire.
Sarah Cox, living your best life. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. As you can tell, I'm a little bit of a fanboy of Sarah's, but I hope you enjoyed the chat as much as I did. And yes, she is living the dream and living her best life. Please join me again in a fortnight's time. We're going to release one of these every other Friday moving forward. Next time I'll be speaking to Patrick Hutchinson, a man who took a decision that took a few seconds and did something that took a few minutes that led to one of the most iconic photos of the last few years, where he was photographed rescuing a kind of white supremacist racist out of a little ruckus at a Black Lives Matter event. And that decision has changed his life. And he is now one of the voices of anti-racism, both in the UK and globally, and is a legend who is, again, based on a snap decision, is now living his best life. So that's in 2 weeks' time. Thank you again for listening. Please come back in a few weeks. Any thoughts, comments, ideas about guests, you can get hold of me at gav@thedolectures.co.uk. In the meantime, stay safe, be happy, and try and live your best life. This podcast was produced by Ashton Main, and the music was specially written, performed, and recorded for us by Ashton Main. So good job, Ash. Take care. See you soon. Bye.
Living Your Best Life with Gav Thompson.